This microphone is for recording. My name is Marty Haugen, and I've been at Holden on and off for the past 5 or 6 years, and I'm going to talk about Vespers in general, specifically about the Vespers we're going to sing tonight at 7:30. How many of you have sung this Vespers before? Okay, well, I want to talk sort of about the whole nature of evening prayer. Give a little background first, and then we'll talk more about this specific setting. I wrote this setting during the winter of 85-86. My family and I were up here for 10 months, and there isn't a lot to do in the winter at Holden except sit around after Vespers and critique it. That was the most exciting thing to do in the village when there's 9 feet of snow outside and it's dark. So about January, somebody suggested one of the values we had in the winter community was talking about our prayer life together. It's interesting about Holden that the only thing the winter community had in common was our intense interest in worship. We came from all kinds of backgrounds, all kinds of agendas, all kinds of spiritualities, all kinds of vocations, ages, whatever. The only thing we had in common, we cared passionately about worship. How we cared about it was very varied. So when they asked me to create a setting, I should have realized, you know, I was really walking into a hornet's nest. But it was interesting for me. I basically have made my adult living as a composer of music for congregations. So this was the ideal laboratory, a congregation that would sit around after the service and give you feedback, I thought. So I wrote this for them, and then we did a critique on it. Then I did another version. We critiqued that, another version. I can take credit or blame for most of the musical texts and all the music. The spoken texts, I have to say, were created by the whole village. And if you want to get into that, I can talk about the places where I agree and disagree with the village. But it really, we worked on the consensus model, which means it during Hunger Awareness Night, it would take us an hour to decide whether or not to have soy sauce with our rice. When you work on the consensus model. So to create a worship service for this group was quite a task. It was probably like doing a hymnal. But anyway, this is the setting that came out of that collaboration. Okay, now let me go back to how I got the ideas for setting it up. Christians have prayed outside of Sunday morning service for almost since the beginning. The earliest Christians in Jerusalem went to the synagogue service, which was essentially readings and psalmody. And they took that tradition with them. So the earliest Christian worship contained the elements and the basis of the Jewish synagogue service. As time went along, Christians who lived very closely in community, the early Christian church really was a very tight community, they felt the need to have an ongoing rhythm of prayer to sort of support them. At the beginning, it just marked the beginning and the end of the day. So for the earliest Christians, the additional services were matins and vespers. They didn't call them matins and vespers. Those names came later. They were just morning prayer and evening prayer. And as monastic orders sprung up, they saw the need to have a regular rhythm of prayer. So the words matins and vespers came out of the hours of the day that the prayer was prayed. They would pray matins and lauds and vespers and compline, and those names became associated with the rhythm of prayer. The idea of those rhythm of prayer was to, throughout the day, constantly bring your mind and your heart back to prayerfulness. The idea was to pray at all times, as Paul would say. So the idea by having a regular rhythm of prayer, you would be praying at all times. The form of evening prayer from its earliest times took on a sort of a three-part form. And that's why I wanted you to get the LBW. I wanted to see. The LBW is very much in line with the way Christians have prayed for centuries. This is page 142 in the LBW. There are three parts to evening prayer. The service of light, and then a middle section, which is psalms and readings and New Testament canticles, and then the third section, which is litanies and prayers. It sort of goes like this. The service of light came for a very practical reason. Vespers was an evening prayer, and before the days of hydroelectric power, it got pretty dark. So the service of light literally was the time when the lamps were lit. The Paschal candle was connected to evening prayer from the very beginning because the image of Christ as the light of the world was very present to the early Christians. So normally they would have a paschal candle, but then there would be lamps around the space that were literally lit during this time. I think the opening procession we have, do you see where it says Jesus Christ is the light of the world? Okay, now hold the Vespers next to it. Open the other one. This is page 3. You can see where we made the changes. I want you to see that we tried to stay within the tradition of the prayer. Do you see how it has three things and it goes, Jesus Christ, you are the light of the world. And you respond, the light no darkness can overcome. Now I'm going to undercut Bill's recording here. Here's the way traditionally for maybe 1,000 years Christians have done that. They would start with the paschal candle out here. And it was basically easy to get people in. So they'd stand in the back of the church and sing with the candle, Jesus Christ, you are the light of the world. Ritual music, from the beginning, the idea of ritual music is always music that is wedded to ritual. And to do music just for its own sake is never a part of worship. Hymns, originally, you don't see it's not quite as obvious, but the hymn of the day is always connected to the word. It just isn't a hymn you just sing because you want to sort of have something to do. It's connected to the word. And this ritual music at the beginning was connected to the procession into the space. The idea of the light coming into our space, into our darkness. The evening hymn is actually, originally was Phos Helaron, the light, the hymn of light. And there's an original Latin text, which I don't know, which dates back to 500-600 AD. And all the later ones are based loosely on translations of that. Joyous Light of Glory, 143. This is an English translation directly of the Phos Helaron, the ancient Greek hymn. Joyous Light of Glory of the Immortal Father, Heavenly, Holy, Blessed Jesus Christ, we have come to the setting of the sun, we look to the evening light. It's all about light, and Jesus is the light. So I created this text basically to image the same thing. I've gotten critiques from some people. It's always fascinating to me when I hear that the Vespers has been used other places than Holden. I really wrote this for the winter community, 85-86, and when I wrote it, I had no idea that it would be used after 85-86 or in any other place. That's why we called it Vespers 86. The idea was we wanted to say it was for this community in this place and this time. And I saw it as an alternative worship, and the reason I titled this alternative worship was I wanted to stress the idea is that the community was talking on an ongoing basis about what worship is when Christians gather. And I created this sort of as an experience as a basis for dialogue and discussion. Worship is an experience, and to talk about worship is a little bit like talking about being in love. It would be like, or talking about jazz, like Louis Armstrong would say, if you don't know what it is, I can't tell you. Jazz is something you experience. Worship is something you experience. So I created this as a basis of experience from which to compare with the LBW Vespers and say, okay, let's critique worship. Theologians can give us a theological critique, which is one valuable part of it. Another valuable part is your own critique, and more than just what does it make me feel, it's what does the text do for me. So I would invite you tonight to try and suspend critical judgment, but just sort of reflect on the experience of prayer. One thing that we try to do with this, at least when I can get involved, is I try and put some spaces into it. To me, my wife put a little plaque on the wall of our house that says, the greatest revelation is stillness, which is a really mean thing to do to a musician. But I've come to see that stillness begins and ends all pieces of music, and that the one thing about this thing is it's all of one piece. That's why I don't like to do hymns in the middle. It's meant to be of a piece, because in monastic prayer, it's a repetitive prayer, and at first glance, it seems boring to do the same thing over and over and over again. But when you reflect upon it, the idea is, it's the image, I heard it once described as water wearing a rock down. For a monastic prayer, over a lifetime, the prayer shapes you. It's a prayer of unvarying regularity, with the readings being the only varying element. And so the readings jump out with a clarity, because you put yourself into this mood of prayer, and then you're preparing yourself to hear the reading. So the service of light is followed by readings. Psalm 41, yes, yes. Carol's asking this for a real specific purpose. Holden is a whole nother animal. Holden doesn't fall under any, because it's already not a monastic rhythm of prayer. Vespers is different every night at Holden. And personally, I suspend all critical judgment when I come to Holden. And I don't mean that to sound bad. I think that's an I come here to sort of grow, and I come here to try and experience. And I would have to experience, and then you can ask me. Does that make sense? The reading is nonverbal tonight, so that's why Carol, I think, raised it maybe. Psalm 141 has always been connected with evening prayer, and I'll tell you a little bit about the key signature. It's in E flat minor and B flat major. I chose those keys because those are, for me, keys of the evening, keys of relaxation. I was sitting at supper tonight with somebody who had to play the psalm, which is in the key of E-flat minor. And if you've ever played the piano, E-flat minor is probably one of the strangest keys you'll ever run into. And he said, well, you know, when you're not around, sometimes we play it in E minor. He said, but you don't care, do you? And I said, well, I mean, I can live with that. The truth is, when I wrote the communion service that we sang last Sunday, I wrote it in the key of E major, which for me is a real bright key, as opposed to E flat, which is a much darker key. You see what I mean? I hope. The Vespers is written in E flat, which to me is a very dark key. To sing, Jesus Christ, you are the light of the world, is much different than, Jesus Christ, you are the light. See the difference? Mozart used to go, yellow, blue. Anyway, he had... I learned this when I was studying the sitar back in Minneapolis, and my teacher said that in India, they have various key signatures and tonalities that are used for various times of the day to evoke various spiritual states. For me, E-flat minor is a key that evokes darkness and candles and incense. So instead of... Here's E-flat minor. Minor. Now, I don't know if immediately it grabs you differently. To me, I hear they sound significant difference in sound. So that's just a real aside. I wrote the Psalm D to be, to me, incense is a wonderful element. I grew up in a small town in southern Minnesota, two Norwegian Lutheran churches in town. There was a Swedish church out in the country, but we didn't talk to them. There were just two Norwegian Lutheran churches, and we had a real, I think common to many Lutheran churches, we had a real aversion to sensual elements in worship. We were very suspect of it, that it smacked of Catholicism or something like that. And it's, as an adult, I've come to appreciate, I think, interestingly enough, I've been working a lot in Roman Catholic parishes, and they have, since their liturgical reform, have stripped away a lot of the more sensual elements. Like, their evening prayer is done much more simply than it was 20 years ago. And so the progressive Catholics are doing very simple evening prayer, where on the other hand, some of the progressive Lutherans have introduced sensual elements. So I see them sort of moving to sort of a more common ground. But when I tried to write this, I was hearing the sound of incense curling up. And I saw two dancers at a major convention dancing the incense psalm. And so I envisioned this in canon. So the whole thing is sung in canon. Let my prayer rise, let my... And I saw two dancers moving like smoke. And that was sort of my image. And this sort of upward motion. I don't know if that's useful or not. It's just sort of the way I was thinking. Then... Once again, like I said before, the texts were created by the community as large, and that's really hard. Like I said, we were all over the map, And the text became a real starting point for theological reflection. We had probably four pastors in the village. That doesn't sound like a lot, but there were only like 55 people here. So the pastors were stuck with not much to do. You know, you got four pastors and only 50 people. So they all became sort of theologians for the rest of us. And four theologians in one congregation is probably three too many, at least. So we spent a lot of time doing theology on text. And it was a very growth-filled experience for me. I learned that committees don't do very good texts. But at the same time, I think we all learned a lot. The only thing I would hope that is that if this community or other communities use this, that they would connect it as often as possible with a dialogue about text. I know that they had a real spirited dialogue after one of the Vespers a few weeks ago. It would be probably more helpful to build that into the structure than have it happen sort of as aftershocks. Because I think, you know, it's going to engender feelings. And I think that was one of the reasons we wrote it. We wanted to do that. We wanted people to think about worship, never to do it carelessly. One of the things, I'll give you a classic example. This is how a committee puts together evening prayer. In the last part of the second section, Psalms, Prayers, and Canticles, is a New Testament canticle. In morning prayer, it's the Canticle of Zechariah. Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel. In the evening prayer, it's always the Magnificat, Mary's great prayer of how God has turned the world upside down, throwing the mighty down and raising the lowly. A wonderful text. So I tried to write a setting of the Magnificat. And then I took it to the group, and the first version only had the Magnificat. And, you know, it had just snowed that night, so there was nowhere to go. The village, avalanches had clothed the road, so we stayed after for an hour and a half after Vespers and critiqued the Magnificat. And somebody said, well, this is wonderful, and I'm real glad we have a hymn in here that a woman wrote. But it doesn't say anywhere in here that a woman wrote this. So you have to get this in here somehow. So we discussed various texts that would talk about the fact that a woman had wrote this, and we couldn't find any way to say it. So somebody came up, and it wasn't me, someone came up with the idea, why don't you set the Annunciation, I think it was one of the theologians, why don't you set the Annunciation to music? Because that would talk about Mary proclaiming the song. So I can't take any credit or blame for the Annunciation being in there. I can only tell you that it doesn't appear in any other evening prayer setting I've ever seen. And it reflects the committee process that we went through. And it also meant that I had a real long, long conversation with my publisher, who couldn't understand why there had to be an Annunciation in an evening prayer setting. But it is of a piece, and I think that's the kind of discussion I think that's worth having for us, because it raised the issues about who owns the liturgy, who's spoken for in the liturgy. So that's just a piece of why that happened. I'm not going to sing through the liturgy right now, because you're going to experience it there, and I don't want to set you up for it. Okay, that's the second half. And we're also going to do, I'm going to try and get us to stand and sit at various places rather than sit through the whole thing to sort of show the different dynamics. Now, if you notice, the first section was all in E-flat major, the service of light. The Psalms and the reading, the Psalm 141 was in E-flat minor. The third section begins with the Magnificat. In other words, the service of light is our gathering into the evening prayer. The readings and the Psalm are our time to reflect on the Word. The canticle and the prayers are our response. Do you see that? So the response begins with the Magnificat. We pray Mary's song. And then it goes right into the litanies. Now, traditionally in evening prayer, the psalm, the prayers are not like on Sunday morning where we invite the prayers of the community. It doesn't mean that we don't care about the individual's prayers and needs. It just means in this regular rhythm of prayer, we try and cover a whole multitude of needs, and it's the ritual of hearing those over and over again. It's not the time necessarily for individual prayer. It's the time for the community prayer together. I got the idea for the litany from the music of Tezay. Can I ask how many of you have heard of the music of Tezay? I'll tell you a little bit about it for those who haven't. Tezay is an ecumenical community in France that was started after the Second World War. They found that because of the nature of their community, they became a very charismatic place for a lot of youth from around the world. And they started developing huge youth gatherings. 20, 30, 40,000 people were coming. And they had to create music for their gatherings. So the head brother, Robert, went to Joseph Gelinot, who was a famous French priest composer, and said, will you compose music for this? And Gelinot said, I don't think I'm the person to do it, but Jacques Berthier could do it. And Jacques Berthier is a French composer lives in Paris, I think, and was commissioned. He also writes exquisite classical music, and he's one of these composers who was given a task. His task was write music that a community of 40,000 people can sing the first time they hear it, and they all speak different languages. So that's a fun task. And he came up with the idea of creating sort of a real right brain kind of music, mantras. And it fit the sort of the monastic nature of the order. Simple, short pieces that would have a simple repeating refrain over which verses from different language could be overlaid. I'll give you an example of a Tezé piece. It's worth singing one, just so you can hear what they sound like.
Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom.
Try the parts. Kind of music you hear once and you can sing it immediately and pray it immediately. I was very moved by this music. And the litanic form of prayer, which is used in evening prayer, fits really well for that, because the litanic prayer is supposed to work on you like a mantra, and the prayers are supposed to just go on and on. The words really are not the most important part at this moment. The most important part is that we, our community, are joining in this prayer with all of the church. So the idea is that the prayers just sort of lay over our singing. Ideally, I wish maybe I hadn't had the humming and the God. I'm on page 10 now. You see where I am? You hum and then sing God of Mercy. If I were to do this again, I think I'd have people sing continuously, because it isn't so important to hear what the cantors are singing as it is just to hear. They function sort of like a flute. It's like the spirit groaning in words too deep. One of the most ironic things for me about this is that language has become a real hot issue, I think, in the Lutheran Church, and probably will become more of a hot issue. I was sitting in I was on a panel once with three other composers. We were brought in to speak to a group of church musicians on the issue of inclusive language. I should have known better to get on a committee like that. But there were four of us up front, and a friend of mine said, "I think we'll just babble until we come to the true wisdom of silence." And he was saying, the words we want aren't there. And I think that's the trouble, is that the realities we're trying to touch are deeper than any of our words. And that's what I was trying to do with this litany, is to say the prayer is important, and what we say is important, but it's always inadequate. So don't focus too much on the words. Focus on the idea that we are praying, and we are praying to this God who can answer all of our prayers, and indeed answers them before we ask them. So let's just try the litany. Maybe you get a sense of that. Start humming. It gets into an area I like to think about is the difference between Kairos and Kronos. Too often, when I worked in my last parish, it was a factory, actually. I worked in a Catholic church that had about 13,000 members in it. And we would have five services on Sunday. And I knew that I had to have the parking lot ready to clear 55 minutes after we started, because otherwise the next service wouldn't be ready. And that was sort of the idea we operate. So we never got from Chronos to Kairos. We always were aware of the watch. Kairos is the circular time of eternity. And the idea of a prayer like this is it opens that possibility easier because the prayer is like a circle. The Kyrie at the beginning of our Sunday morning worship is the same idea. But when I did the communion service, I knew that I couldn't do that for 4 minutes because no church would ever do it because you're so conscious on Sunday morning of time. Mm. But originally the Kyrie as well came out of that sense of a litany that went on and eventually dissolved time and become the Kairos. I got through the whole thing already. You want to ask questions and make comments? I can talk more about it, but I want to get a sense whether this is useful or what else you'd like to address with it. Yeah. When, in the evening, you mean? Really? Okay. Stay with us now, for it is morning. Sort of. I'm real glad it's used. I'm surprised to hear it gets used during the week, too. I didn't know that Lutherans did evening prayer a lot during the week, but I guess it's been used in a number of places during Lent or Advent for evening prayer. I wonder how you'd adapt it for morning. It seems pretty heavily weighted toward evening. But, well, I mean, if you can do it, I'd love to see how you did that. Other comments or questions? I frankly am really surprised that it got used other places because I really wrote it for this community, and I would have written a different one if I was intending to write something for a larger group. Not another evening prayer, no. I'm going to try and write a matins. I'd like to write a matins. Yeah, Ingrid? Oh. Doesn't everybody sing it? Oh, no, they don't, do they? No. I could, you know, if you want to, we can talk a little bit about the real language sticking points, but we only got 15 minutes. You want to open that particular can of worms? Okay. If I remember right, I listened to the forum that was held here about 3 weeks ago, and not to rehash it for those who were here on the staff, but the two issues that were raised were centered around two moments in the prayer, one of which I will take the credit and blame for and one of which I won't. A theologian, a real respected theologian, Walt Bowman, said the two places where you cannot really comfortably mess with text was in a Trinitarian formula blessing and in the Lord's Prayer. And, of course, we messed with both of them here. The closing I created on the back page, "May God Creator bless us and keep us," I was trying to really keep a sense of God the Creator, Christ, and Spirit. But it definitely is very different. You don't ever hear Father, Son, and Holy Ghost anywhere in the setting. And the other place was Abba, Ima on page 11. Now I'll tell you how that evolved. This is another committee process. I had originally put Abba, and someone said that it should be equal time, so it became Abba, Ima. So that's the other committee move. I felt like Abba was probably, to me, and here's my theologian, to me the real intimate shift was for Jesus, who took this "I am who I am" God of the Israelites, who was the unspeakable name. To speak God's name was blasphemy, and said Abba, which was probably an intimate name. What I understand, a little bit of study I've done in Christology led me to think that there were some Pharisees who at this time were trying to have renewal movement where they were also, that Jesus, other people in Israel, raise the same kind of issues. I think what was shocking and revolutionary was not that Jesus chose a male name, but that Jesus chose an intimate name. And I wanted to retain a sense of intimacy. And for me, Abba is close enough to Daddy so that it maybe had that kind of effect. Comments? Because I know it's a real... No comments. Yeah, Barb. Pater would have been Latin, it would have been the equivalent of pater.
Yeah, I mean, it's both father, and we have the conjecture behind them in Greek. It's saying that he's speaking Aramaic, and he probably... Or
he oh, he might have used the word for father, a more distant word?
Yeah, or, so that the Abba, I mean, we have it in the what, Galatians and Romans, so there's certainly the knowledge that Christians use Abba. I mean, Paul says it, or there's crying Abba. But that's the only Aramaeans who have that idea that Jesus calls Father Abba.
And that's a second generation.
He thought it was very sectarian in the way that we changed it on our own up here in the mountains.
Do you want to say something, Elmer, before I respond to that?
No.
Holden is the only place I've heard Abba Ema linked together. Now, I may not have been around. I have heard other translations than Our Father used other denominations. If you're talking mainline, Lutheran, Episcopalian maybe, but I've been to Mennonite services and UCC services that have used different languages. So. I suppose if you talk about the ICET text approved by the International Committee on English Texts, but that isn't in the entire Christendom either. There, Elmer.
Yeah, that's one of the problems with Holden is that he's cultivated so much that he goes on and on.
I saw it as being used for the winter community,
right,
basically. For me, the greatest strength of Holden when it comes to worship is that Holden forces questions to be asked. And I think of all of us on all the sides of issues. And I think there's something good in that. If you take something that you experience from Holden back to your own parish, then the question is you have to continue to ask the questions where you are and don't just do it without thinking. The important issue is to me is, I think, like I said before, the language we use is all inadequate. The important thing is that we can keep searching for to make it as true as we can. Other comments? Yes. I don't have a clue. I haven't done enough research to know what would be done in other languages. It's sort of, for me, it's sort of like jazz once again, where when we try and play our music on a keyboard, play jazz, play African music on a Western keyboard, and what you're trying to play is in the crack. And if this is father and mother, what we want is somewhere in between those two notes. And so we end up doing this, and it's in there, and it doesn't really ring true. And that's the way I feel with a lot of our language. Yeah. And I think we all know we want an intimate word. We don't want a generic, neutered word. And the word just isn't there. A friend of mine, Bob Hurd from Berkeley, has been doing a lot of work with what he calls complementary language, where he tries to use intimate, gender-related language and alternate it within the service. The trouble with that is, of course, it still sets off bells in people's minds. but he's trying to be respectful of the need to address God in a very personal way. Yeah. Now, Joe Camacho was talking to me about his parents, and that was exactly the language he used. Once again, that's why I felt like I like to have a session like this before we do the Vespers, so this very issue can be addressed, because then when you pray it, you're sort of, it gives us a chance, a starting point to think. You're right. If I came and all I heard was, we use inclusive language here, then suddenly I'm feeling like, you know, I've been left out of the dialogue. Yeah. Because I think it's important that we do that, and it's also important that we talk about it. Any other comments? Yeah, Ingrid. I don't know that. I don't know. I don't know. I'm not going to second guess him. I'm hesitant to sort of put words in Walt's mouth without giving him a chance to respond. The forum is really interesting. If you want to listen to it, it's in the tape library. It made me real glad I could listen to it on the tape instead of sit there in the room. But it was worthwhile. Any other questions? Yeah, Barb. I think he said it was part of our sort of covenant with the people in our parish that once in every prayer we use that formula. At least what I picked up from the, and I've heard somebody describe it as sort of a ritual contract with the congregation, that if you get up and use. Yeah. Yeah, I like that a lot too. Other comments? I want to give the poor people in the tape ministry enough time to set up for Vespers. So if you don't have any other questions, I'd be real interested afterwards, those who've never heard the Vespers, any kind of comments, pro or con, I would appreciate. If you could, you can stay if you want, but the LBWs can go back in the rack. Thank you.
Yeah. Is there a change in key between here and here?
No, there is. It's missing.
Okay.
No, it's not a change in key. It's my own not thinking.